From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. The news covers the horrors and evils of life as they happen. But what happens afterward? For some, it's the architecture of hope.
One of the missions of architecture is to heal, to bring something good, something positive, in face of tragedy, in face of ultimate destruction. To build something is an act of affirmation.
Architect Daniel Libeskind, in just a moment. Today, we look at evil's aftermath. One writer's post-September 11th memoir, and a look at Joseph Stalin, man and monster.
When he was absolutely a penniless nobody and a prisoner in the exile in Siberia, he was never without a mistress and left illegitimate children all over the place.
Also, Jewish culture in Poland after the Holocaust.
Klezmer gets you moving. It's, you know, laughing and crying in the same phrase. And it has become sort of a stereotypical, like a soundtrack for the Jewish experience.
When the Twin Towers collapsed on September 11th, they left a hole in the hearts of Americans, as well as the New York skyline. Now a new master plan for the site has been selected. Architect Daniel Libeskind won the competition for the site. It's his vision that will do its best to rebuild the skyline and commemorate the tragedy of 9/11. Libeskind has a new book out. It's called Breaking Ground. Steve Paulson asked Libeskind to describe his design.
Big office buildings, which spiral upwards, and they contain many, many offices, some of the tallest buildings in the world, stand around the memorial in a kind of circular composition and end up with the Freedom Tower. And that entire composition of buildings around the memorial is like the Torch of Liberty that I saw as a teenage immigrant coming to the harbor of New York. And of course, the Freedom Tower itself is a representation of that liberty because it has an asymmetrical spire. It is a very dynamic building whose roof is also sloping towards the memorial, so that the whole silhouette and the positioning of the building are part of the meaning of the master plan.
Now, I know some people have not responded so kindly to the Statue of Liberty reference. I mean, it might seem a little jingoistic to some, or maybe even kitschy, because the Statue of Liberty is such a catch-all symbol of New
York City.
You know,
I never accepted it, because when you live under communist dictatorship, as I did, and when you come to New York and you see the Statue of Liberty, it's not a trinket or a piece of rhetoric that belongs to some political party. It's a flame of freedom that continues to emblazon the whole sky of New York and America with what it stands for. If the Statue of Liberty ever becomes just a rhetorical symbol, we will have lost the sense of who we are. The same thing is why I fought for 1776. To me, the Declaration of Independence is not some, you know, little document to be found in the back of a book. It's the central acknowledgement of human liberty in America and in the world as the first real democracy to be born in a long, long series of eons. So to me, these are crucial, and they actually unite Americans. I have not yet met a single person who, if they don't think deeply about it, doesn't appreciate what they stand for.
Now, 1776 is how tall your tower will be, 1,776 feet.
That's right. And after all, as the Declaration of Independence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and that our Creator gave us life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. This is something that should be inscribed into the sky of New York, because it's not just about making a high tower. Anybody can make a high tower in any place, in Singapore, in Nairobi, in Shanghai, but a tower that will forever speak meaningfully to the public that will come to this very, very unique site, which will forever be a kind of site representing the sacrifice of those who perished, but also the resurgence of the city, the resurgence of democracy.
Did you talk with families who had suffered losses during 9/11?
Oh, absolutely. Subsequently, you know, we were in the early part of the competition not allowed to speak directly to them. But the families got in touch with us. We got in touch with them. We spoke with their representatives. And later on, we got to know many of them who became and remain very good friends of ours. And that was one of the most moving aspects. How do you reconcile the fact that this is a place that forever will be a sad place too, and yet design the entire space, the 16 acres, as a living memorial, something that is also taking the sacrifice of these citizens and showing that New York is going into the future with that memory as a center of its site?
What did they tell you that they wanted? What kind of a memorial did they want?
Well, I'll tell you, there were two fathers who both lost their sons. And one of them, his son was a fireman. And at some point after I won the competition, they unrolled a piece of paper to me. It was a map. And I've never seen anything like this. I was so shocked. It was a long piece of paper, and it had about a million red dots on it, on the site of Ground Zero. And I didn't understand what it was until they explained to me that they had chartered every body part on that site. The entire site was, you know, as if each of these red spots would kind of explode in your heart and your head when you understood what it was. Later on, when I was unveiling the plans with all the other participants in Federal Hall for the Freedom Tower, the memorial, all the things, these two parents, these two fathers who lost their children came over to me and said, you know, Mr. Libeskind, you didn't disappoint us. You restored the skyline in a way that is inspiring, and you went all the way down to Bedrock to the memorial to commemorate our kids. And I was very moved.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, what do you do if you see this kind of a map that marks all the different body parts? I would think that would just be kind of overpowering.
It's overpowering. You don't talk to people for a day after that. You don't just go on business as usual. You meditate and you see that this site is so difficult. That is not a site, you know, which is kind of business as usual. And in the book, I actually tell the story that this is about my life and how I came to design, how I came to be lucky and also humbled by being chosen as a master planner. But at the same time, it's also a story of America. It's how immigrants came here, how I came here, how the Statue of Liberty isn't going to ever be something appropriated by some political party. And at the same time, it's a story of my parents, who were Holocaust survivors, who believed in America, who had tough lives working in sweatshops and factories, and yet never gave up the notion that this is the beauty of this country, that there is truth here, and there is something open-minded and inspiring.
Tell me about your parents. You mentioned that they were Holocaust survivors in Poland, and they ended up fleeing from there. And from what I understand, they were later imprisoned in Soviet camps?
In the Soviet camps, yes. They were, you know, imprisoned. They didn't know each other. They were married later on. But my father was imprisoned in the Volga in one of the KGB camps. My mother was sent all the way to Siberia, to the Gulag.
This is because they were Jews?
Yes. Both. They were Jews and they were Polish citizens who refused to give up their citizenships. Many people who escaped to the Soviet Union said, okay, we'll become Russians in order not to suffer the humiliation of being arrested. But my parents stood up to communists. They refused to renounce their Jewishness or their Polish citizenships. And as a result, they were incarcerated. My mother was not so lucky as my father because he was in just a work camp that people kind of died from starvation. She was in Siberia in conditions that were really deadly. Most people perished from starvation and from the cold. Her health never recovered. But again, my parents taught me certain lessons that even under extreme situations, you don't give up. My mother's story where she was abused by the guards, she and a series of Polish women who were called by the KGB officer in the Gulag, took out just instinctively the inkwell that was on his desk and threw it at a portrait of Stalin, which was immediately behind him. He put his hand next to his gun, but then said, get out of my office. He could have killed her and all the others with her, but he didn't. And she was a tough woman. You know, when she came to New York, she worked in a sweatshop, and she organized a strike. She worked in a fur factory where the conditions were pretty tough, not just chemicals, but there were no towels in the bathrooms, there was no soap. She led a strike against both her employers and against the union, which she felt was equally not noble, to get for the workers towels and soap so they could wash themselves when they finished this gruesome labor. So again, I learned to be inspired by my parents, and they were good people and people who would never be impressed by, you know, marble and just hollow power.
Well, it's interesting what you said about how architecture is not just about marble. I mean, you're really saying that a building is not just the materials that it's made of. It's got to mean something bigger. I mean, and that's really what you're getting at. You're talking about the emotion of architecture, the emotion of these kinds of spaces that you create.
Absolutely. I think too many people have gotten so brainwashed that kind of neutral buildings are fine, that a kind of a box that looks like a refrigerator on the horizon is just all you need. No, you need something inspiring. A window that you have opens a new view, a door, even a door handle. The kind of space you have has a big effect on your spirit and on your mind and on the way you work and on the way you think of your family, friends, and the world. So the building does have to be compelling and have emotion. You know, neutrality, a kind of neutral box. And neutrality is not a value, and indifference is not, you know, a virtue. And I always thought that great buildings in history are the buildings that have an impact, that mean something, that tell a story, and that go across ages telling that story to a new generation of people.
Now, one of your most famous buildings is the Jewish Museum in Berlin. And of course, you're dealing with a lot of loaded history there. I mean, your own history as well as what happened to so many Jews. How do you turn that history, that horror, that pain, into a building that people want to go into?
Well, it's a great question. It's difficult to answer, but I think you have to be an optimist. And I've always believed that as an architect, you don't have the luxury to be a pessimist. You can be a pessimist if you're a writer, an economist, a politician, a poet. But as an architect, you're trying to create a better world, a better space for people, something uplifting. And I thought, how do I deal with this difficult history, Germans and Jews, the Holocaust, and yet bring light? Because there is a new generation, and there must be hope in a city. If there was no hope, what would history mean? It would be nothing. So I thought, I have to design a building that speaks to people, that communicates not just intellectually about history, because people know that history intellectually, but makes you feel it in the acoustics of your footsteps, in the temperature of the building, in the voids of the building, in the shattered light that penetrates through the building. And I have to say that I was glad that even before the building had exhibitions, hundreds of thousands of people came to see it because they got the story. They were part of it. Nobody had to explain it to them. They felt it. And I felt that's really part of the mission of a building.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things, the temperature of the building, the way your footsteps sounded. How did you work out those details?
Well, you know, I did something very obscure in the building. I wanted to complete an opera, which was never completed in Berlin, by Arnold Schoenberg, famous German-Jewish composer, called Moses and Aaron. He couldn't complete it because he didn't know where the word of God was in those dark times. And I decided I would complete it in the footsteps of the visitors, the echoing footsteps, which go across a structure I call the void, a kind of empty space, which has no exhibitions. It's a concrete, raw space, very, very gloomy, but very powerful, in which suddenly you become aware of your footsteps. In the Holocaust Tower, I convinced the Senator of Berlin, who was my client, not to put any heating in the winter, not to put any cooling in the summer, to make it freezing in the winter when you open the door, and hot in the summer, because that's what it felt like in those grim days. And people do enter that building, and they have an experience, and they see something beyond simply the exhibitions. Of course, the exhibitions are key and very important, but you have to feel something. And I compare it to the fact that when, you know, you listen to music, you listen to the violin, you don't hear horsehair being rubbed, you know, on a gut. And when you hear a piano, you don't hear, you know, wooden mallets hitting, you know, metal sticks. You hear the piano. You hear a piano sonata. You hear a violin concerto. That's what architecture has to do. It has to kind of step back to allow something more important to happen, which is a story.
Now, both the World Trade Center Memorial and the Jewish Museum in Berlin are dealing with evil, are dealing with horrific things that have happened. How can architecture respond to evil?
Well, you've asked a very profound question, but one of the missions of architecture is to heal, to bring something good, something positive in face of tragedy, in face of ultimate destruction. To build something is an act of affirmation, because building requires an effort to create something that is constructed, that is going to be there. It's not going to evaporate. It's not going to be filed away in a library or on a shelf or in an archive. It's going to be always there as part of your memory. And in that sense, architecture addresses tragedy, addresses the void created by the Holocaust, by what happened to New York and to the world on 9/11, has to respond with a very creative statement, which is both addressing what has happened there, not neglecting it, not forgetting it, but forever marking it, and at the same time moving forward, showing that there must be hope, that there must be faith for history to have a meaning.
One last question. Do you worry about another attack? I mean, I suppose one of the lessons of the World Trade Center is that these kinds of huge buildings can come down again. They can collapse if someone is intent on bringing them down. Is that sort of in the back of your mind, the impermanence of architecture?
Absolutely. I mean, cities are vulnerable. They've always been vulnerable. But I have always believed we cannot suddenly become different. We cannot put our heads in the sand. And, you know, we have to assert that this is a democratic city. This is not a fortress. We have to make safer buildings. We have to make buildings that now have to respond to new conditions and new threats. And we are working on that, absolutely. Not just on this building, but on the entire site. We've become aware that the world is a dangerous place. But at the same time, we say on this site, and I say it, that this site is going to be an open site. That when a child comes to this site, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, who never heard of, you know, was not born, he or she will still feel, my God, New York is a beautiful place. Democracy is incredible. These people did not die in vain.
Daniel Libeskind talking with Steve Paulson. Liebeskind's design won the competition for the new World Trade Center site. His book is called Breaking Ground. Like most Americans, David Wyatt will never forget 9/11. As events unfolded, Wyatt needed an outlet for his emotions on that day, so he started writing. The result is the memoir, And the War Came, the story of the changes Wyatt's family went through after September 11th. Wyatt read a passage from his book for Anne Strandchamps.
This is an entry that begins, Dennis, Massachusetts, September 11th, 2001. Up a little before 9 this morning, coffee and grape nuts. Another clear, warm day at the Cape. We've had more than 4 weeks of this weather. The phone rings. Have you heard? A quavering voice asks. It's Barbara, Anne's cousin in Newton. Anne is my wife. Terrorists have bombed New York and planes are missing. Two of them took off from Logan Airport. Chris is on a plane out of there. I don't know if it's landed. I had to call somebody. Where is he headed? I ask her. Denver. As Barbara keeps talking, the door opens and Anne is back from the market. She went out for the New York Times. I turn on the TV. It's about 10 in the morning. There is an image of the World Trade Center. A plane flies toward it. The plane disappears. Then I see a huge orange ball of flame and pieces of the building falling. A voice says something about Pearl Harbor. We won't turn off the TV today.
How did you and your family react to the news in the days that followed?
Well, I had a son in Washington, D.C., and a daughter in New York at St. Vincent's Hospital, where she was a third-year resident. So we had people we loved close to both sites. And we got in touch. People who hadn't spoken in years began to speak again. We quickly returned to our home in Charlottesville, Virginia, and took up our life again. We own a restaurant there together, my wife and I. I'm also a professor of English, so I was on leave that fall, but I had to do business back at school. We resumed our daily life, but we found, as we did so, a deeper sense of the meaning of what it is to be a citizen of this country. And there were odd moments where we would find ourselves reading the newspaper and weeping over an editorial. And there's a passage I'd like to read which describes such an occasion. Michael Kelly writes today in an editorial entitled, We Know Who We Are, that there are, quote, those on the left and right who hate this country for being what it is, a liberal democracy. He maintains that, quote, we are good people and we have built what is in fact a just and fair and decent place, and we will preserve this place from those who would destroy it. But when tears have been pushed out, it's been by a feeling almost akin to pride, a big swelling in the chest of recognition that I have an almost searing love for this country.
It sounds as though one of the things that 9/11 did to you was brought you more in touch with your own feelings of love for your family, for the country. It just brought more love into your life.
Well, that's a lovely way to put it, and I think you're right. I see this fall for me and for many people as the occasion for the return of emotion. And big pieces of myself began breaking loose and coming to the surface. So yes, it was an opening in that sense. It was a terrible wound, but also it was a reawakening. And of course, the major thing was the way we reconnected, not just with love of country, which was deeply important, but with maybe our lost loved ones.
Tell me something about your family situation, because now, part of what happened, you discovered in the wake of 9/11, is that family members who had been estranged began to come together.
Well, my father had moved to Charlottesville about 4 years before the event. He was in his late 70s. And my father hadn't spoken to a few of my sisters for 20 years. And they began to call each other, and they began to reconnect. And what happens is that my dear sister from Seattle made plans to visit Charlottesville and brought her husband and her daughter to Charlottesville for Thanksgiving, and my father and sister and husband and daughter sat down for the first time together in their lives in the restaurant I own on the day before Thanksgiving. And this was all in part a result of having been, you might say, cracked open by the events of that fall.
Near the end of the book, a lot of the changes you're talking about that were taking place with your family kind of coalesce around a Thanksgiving dinner. I wondered if you'd tell me a little bit of that story and what made that particular Thanksgiving so memorable.
Well, the dinner takes place at my college roommate's farm about 50 miles north of Charlottesville. So it's a return to a place of friendship of over 30 years. And we bring together my father and my sister and her husband and daughter and my son and Anne's children from her previous marriage. So we have all these blended families, these scattered lives that come together on this beautiful fall day in the Piedmont of Virginia. And everybody brings food and sits down. And then after dinner, Barney, my old friend, asks us all to say something. And I don't have much to say. I just say, we all join hands and I say, I'm grateful for the hospitality, for having this place to come to, and for being here with these people. It wasn't a complex emotion, but it was one I hadn't been able to feel before, at least not in the presence of this particular group of people. And so I think of Thanksgiving as a particularly American holiday, the day where we celebrate without a great deal of fanfare or excess. We celebrate our solidarity and our history and our cooking and our families and friends. And so I was happy that our particular private story could intersect with that wonderful public holiday.
Did the changes that took place in you and in your family after 9/11, have those stuck around? Or are your guards back in place and people drifting apart again?
Some of them have stuck around, but it is arresting to admit that many of the changes didn't and probably couldn't have held, so that some of the bridges that were crossed, some of the reunions that took place didn't last. And I guess I've had to accept that these moments of happiness, of inherent excellence, are often temporary, that the deeper wounds sometimes reassert themselves. And while the book doesn't tell that story, I think what happened to my family, the way in which the reunion didn't entirely change things, it was also true for the country, that looking back from 3 years later, we can all see that some of the good things that happened didn't entirely allow us to hold together in the ways we might have wished.
It's a mixed feeling, isn't it, to be nostalgic for what was a tragic time?
That's a very nice way of putting it. I think that's what's stunning. I always find myself wanting to use two words, like wonderful and terrible. One adjective just won't do.
David Wyatt's the author of the book, And the War Came. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs. Coming up next, celebrating Jewish culture in Poland.
If it's played with sincerity, you know, it has the human condition in every note. And that's what I think klezmer evokes.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Here's how Yale Strom's documentary Klezmer on Fish Street begins. When you travel to Krakow, Poland, you can stay in the former Jewish quarter at a Jewish inn. You will wake up to a kosher-style breakfast. You will take the Schindler's List tour. You will end your day with a kosher-style dinner, followed by a klezmer concert. Will you have met a Polish Jew?
I think for a lot of Jews, Poland represents a cemetery. It's where the largest part of our people in Europe was killed. And the pain associated with that historical fact makes many Jews very sour about the Polish experience.
Until very recently, no Jew would come to Poland to have a good time. He traveled to Poland maybe, but he didn't come as a tourist. Now many Jews are coming to Poland as tourists to enjoy it. You can enjoy Krakow, you can enjoy Poland in a way that was impossible to do some years ago.
I think klezmer music is one small aspect of the larger theme of Jewish identity, Jewish culture, what it means for people who are Jews. And settling this question, what does this Jewish music mean to me, is a way of saying, how do I want to be Jewish?
A taste of the documentary Klezmer on Fish Street. And here's Steve Paulson talking with Yale Strom about the film and about klezmer in Poland.
There are several klezmer bands in Poland today, all of which don't have any Jews in the band. They're all non-Jews playing klezmer music. So what is this film about? The film is about, really, this revival of Jewish culture in Poland, Yiddish culture, really. You know, once there were 3.5 million Jews in Poland that had lived nearly 1,000 years, created a 1,000-year-old rich Yiddish culture, and 90% of them were wiped out. And so we have, like, 60 years later after the Holocaust, we have this revival being almost fostered by non-Jews for non-Jews.
How many Jews in Poland are
well,
there?
Well, good question. Officially, they always say officially, they say it is as low as, you know, 6,000 to 8,000.
In the whole country?
In the whole country. But really, people have been doing work there, and friends of mine have been working there, Americans who've gone there to do research and to help also build back the community. There's probably closer to 20, 25,000 Jews. So that begs the question, so where are they? Who are they? Many of them are Jews, changed their last name. They wanted to hide, go into the fabric. They were children that grew up in families from parents who were survivors and said, you know, yes, you're Jewish, but that's it. It only caused trouble and your life is fine. You don't need to add to it. Also, there are many people who were orphaned and stayed there and were brought up by Catholics and are only finding out now in their 40s and their 50s that they're Jewish. A relative tells them, or the mother or father who's raised them, I must tell you, though, that you came to me as a year-and-a-half-year-old child and so forth. And that creates a weird, ironic mix to then say, now we're going to recreate Jewish culture for you.
Mm-hmm. So what you're describing is essentially a culture that's, for the most part, been wiped out in Poland. I mean, there are virtually no Jews left, and there were many Jews who used to live there before the Second World War. And now there is this budding industry of Jewish music, Jewish culture. I mean, your film is set in Krakow.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you can stay at so-called Jewish inns. You can eat kosher-style meals. You can go on the Schindler's List tour. All this stuff.
And why? Some people say it's guilt for guilt, you know, money for guilt. Some feel guilty and you know, the children or the grandchildren. And we want to give something back because when you look at Polish history, you cannot ignore Jewish history. It was so intertwined. And they're realizing this. They're saying, wow, there's a hole in the fabric. You know, a 20-year-old who reads and so forth say, wow, look at these industrialists, these writers, these musicians, these architects, these actors, and so forth and so on, who contributed to our culture. They were Poles, and they were Jewish.
Where does klezmer music fit into this story?
Klezmer music, Yiddish instrumental folk dance music, which has been around since about the 13th century. Actually, I wrote a book, I might as well say it on air, you know, I wrote a book recently called The Book of Klezmer, and it dates it from the late 1200s through today, starting in Germany and eventually coming to Poland. So klezmer, though, in America was sort of in the 50s when American Jews were assimilating. I don't want to eat the pastrami sandwich. I don't have the garlic on my breath. You know, I'm leaving the sweatshops in Hester Street and I'm going to Long Island. That kind of mentality. And at my bar mitzvah for my wedding, play one hora, play Hava Nagila. But the rest of it, I want to hear, you know, whatever, Duke Ellington, you know, Benny Goodman or whatever the popular music of the day. Jews in the 70s said, you know, what I call like the Roots syndrome with the movie Roots, said, wait a minute, I'm playing bluegrass, I'm playing Irish. What about my Roots music? And slowly listening to the old 78s, talking to some of the old timers who remembered it as just Catskills, you know, Borscht Belt music. And slowly this revival came back.
So there is a real klezmer revival
in
now.
Definitely throughout the world. Majorly so. I mean, you know, in late 70s, you could go and there's like five records and then not CDs, I guess. Today, there must be a couple hundred bands throughout the world. You know, I started a band in 1981 called Zamiros. Now I changed the name called Clash because it's mixed with jazz. And I have a band in New York called Hot Pastrami. But where's it come in is the music then crossed the Atlantic. Musicians said, wow, I can get gigs in Europe. They're fascinated. Germany, France, Holland, Italy even. And then Poland, Hungary. And the people said, well, first of all, wait a minute. I'm hearing strains of my folk music, like Polish folk music. I hear, yes, there's some different. There's that Middle Eastern kind of, you know, melismatic sort of crying sounds. And what it was for Poles who didn't know much about Jewish culture or maybe knew very little to nothing, it was a way to be introduced to Jewish culture in a non-threatening, non-invasive way. I'm not going to go to the synagogue. I have no interest to learn Hebrew or the Torah. Or I'm not going to start taking Jewish studies classes. I'm going to go to a club, sit back, sip a beer, and listen to some good music.
Now, it's worth pointing out that you are a man of many talents, not only a filmmaker and a writer, but also a musician. And you have brought your violin into the studio. Could you give us a taste of klezmer music?
Definitely, certainly. I'll play a tune that comes from a town that's today in Belarus, but it was once part of Poland, Greater Poland, a tune that is what we call a niggin, a Hasidic melody, a wordless melody that comes from the town where my grandparents grew up. Now they can be also fast, upbeat.
First tune, very soulful. It's the kind of thing that you would hear in a movie made about Poland in the 1930s or something
Jewish
like that.
Jewish blues.
Yes, exactly. And then the second one, and you can imagine people in a club playing that. You know, if you want to go out and have a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the klezmer music has a wide range of emotions, and because it's music of the folk, and folk music of any ethnic group touches humans. That's why, you know, people say, I like klezmer, but I'm not Jewish. I said, well, you know, I like Swedish music, and I'm not Swedish. Or I like, you know, Malian music, and I'm not from Mali. Because it's from the folk, and if it's played with sincerity, you know, it has the human condition in every note. And that's what I think klezmer evokes.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the questions your film, Klezmer on Fish Street, raises is, to go back to Poland, to Krakow, where you spent a lot of time, can you have Jewish culture put on, performed by people who aren't Jews?
That is a good question. That's a very difficult question. You know, yes, you can have non-Jews who've studied it, who've lived it. But the one thing that non-Jew, who's as great as he or she is, the virtuosity on the violin playing the style of klezmer, doesn't have when they play is when they close their eyes and think back to their childhood, they don't have those memories as I did, listening to the stories from my Zeta and my grandfather, going to a small Hasidic synagogue, hearing the DNA of the music. The DNA comes from the synagogue, the shul, as we would say in Yiddish. They don't have that. And even if they said, well, I'm going to go to the shul now. Well, okay, but you're going as an adult. There is something to be said about literally getting it from mother's milk. Mm-hmm. As a character says in one of my films I did some years ago called The Last Klezmer, he says, I learned from, you know, drinking on my mother's breast, in a sense. You know, he's making a joke, but...
Well, and it's very easy to be cynical about, say, this kind of Jewish revival, whatever you want to call it, in Krakow, where there are hardly any Jews who live there. But yet, on the other hand, you could say it's better than nothing. You know, if they're not doing it, there's going to be no vestige of Jewish culture, and why not?
Right. And as the film says, and I agree, I mean, you know, I will admit, you know, I have misgivings or mixed feelings sometimes, not even just in Poland. When I've been to Hungary, there's this Jewish festival now in Budapest building, you know, or I go to Prague or Bratislava in Slovakia. Because I think, wow, I mean, these people are loving their music, but where were their grandparents? You know, where were they when they could have saved, you know, my brethren when they were being taken to the trains? Or were these the grandparents that their grandparents couldn't wait to go in and rob and take everything out of their homes? But yes, it is, as many of the people see in that film, as my friend Stashik, who's Jewish in the film, he says, and he was born and lived there his whole life. You know, we could have nothing or a little of something, and I'd rather have a little of something.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Well, it's my pleasure to be invited, and thank you.
And, you know, before you go, because you have your violin here, could you play us one more song?
Sure.
Yale Strom is a klezmer musician and the director of the documentary Klezmer on Fish Street. Steve Paulson spoke with him. For more information about the films and music featured on To the Best of Our Knowledge, stop by our website at www.ttbook.org. Drop us a note while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up next, Life Under a Tyrant, Joseph Stalin.
This is a picture of religious, almost religious fanaticism, and these were believers.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking this hour about what happens in the wake of terror, heartbreak, and evil. After Hitler, the name with the darkest history in modern memory is arguably Joseph Stalin. Stalin's stranglehold on the Soviet Union represented an era of brutally enforced tyranny. Little was known about Stalin the man, but Simon Montefiore aims to change that with his new book, Stalin, the Court of the Red Tsar. Montefiore had access to recently released letters and personal documents never before seen by biographers. Tracking down Stalin and his cronies was an eerie experience for him.
I went to all the houses where Stalin lived and spent a lot of his time, especially on the Black Sea, where he sometimes ruled the Soviet Union from there for long periods. And I think, you know, the Stalin that I reveal, the world that I reveal, is very different from that which we're accustomed, and it is all based on these archives. So it's absolutely real. I've handled these archives myself. They often smelt of Stalin's pipe. Sometimes they were soaked in tears of people who'd wrote to him begging for life, and he kept their letters. You know, oftentimes there were dirty drawings, jokes passed around the table signed by Molotov and Beria and Stalin and so on. I mean, this is it. This is how it really was. And for the first time, we can say we don't tolerate the fact that Stalin was just an enigma or, you know, we can't understand Stalin. Now we really could know him for the first time.
What's fascinating about these, I think, or one of the many things that's fascinating about them, is that Stalin and his henchmen come alive as people. You don't think of Stalin as anything but a mass murderer, certainly not as someone who was a doodler or a jokester or capable of pulling up the blanket on a friend who was ill. And in fact, one of the most difficult things for me reading your book was discovering that people liked him.
Yes, I think that's fascinating. Of course, I mean, he'd never have risen to power if he hadn't been very good with people. I mean, that's the thing, that's one of the big things that's been missing. I mean, most biographies of Stalin traditionally have portrayed him as this kind of dreaded, fearsome, satanic figure, seething all the time and everyone being terrified of him. Of course, if he'd been like that, he'd never have risen to power and he'd never have stayed in power. So Stalin the charmer, the people person. Now, I'm not saying that Stalin was a normal person. As Stalin himself said, abnormal people appear all the time in history. He said, politicians are always abnormal people, he said. Mm-hmm. And that was very true. It applied to him. He lacked empathy, but he was very charming. And, you know, there are umpteen examples of what I tell. But for example, when Beria moved to Moscow, Stalin chose his house, chose his car, asked his wife if she liked the house. When she said she didn't, he found her another house. He checked the heating worked. He arrived to check the kitchen was functioning. And then he tucked in Beria's 10-year-old son himself and read him stories in bed. I mean, this is how Stalin rose to power.
Clearly, he had discovered something along the way. Now, you actually dispose of his early life in not very many pages at all. And the story that you tell begins when his wife committed suicide. This establishes, I guess, some of the ground rules for the Stalin that was to come. But by this time, he had already established himself as one of the leaders, if not the leader, who was going to dominate the Soviet Union for decades to come.
Yes, I mean, the book starts in 1929 when Stalin was acclaimed Vozhd, the leader, Lenin's successor. And the reason why it's called The Court of the Red Tsar is this is essentially a court history of Stalin. As I said, it's about the 30 years of supreme power, the reign. I call that The Court. I use the expression Red Tsar not for a tabloid headline, but because Stalin himself talked about himself continually as the Tsar. He said the Russian people need a Tsar. He said to his mother, I'm like the Tsar. He studied the history of the Tsars in enormous detail and worshipped at the feet of Peter the Great and Ivan the Terrible especially. And yes, this is about him in power. But I start with, as a prologue, the suicide of his wife, because it's a night in which one can see very clearly, meet the main characters and see how they lived in the Kremlin, how they danced, how they sang, how they ate, how they flirted, how they were all incestuously linked in a tiny, tiny little circle of people who'd known each other 30 years. And then how this tragedy hit Stalin himself. And it was a terrible blow to his self-esteem.
Tell me a little bit about these people who surrounded him. Were they as much believers in Bolshevism as Stalin was himself? Was Beria,
yes,
the secret policeman, for instance?
Yes, I think he was in his earlier days, though he was probably the most opportunistic. I mean, he would say things to his family. I mean, I managed to get to meet and know the Beria family, which is fascinating. They loved him, of course, and he was a family man, at the same time as being a great womanizer and a rapist and a sadist and all the other terrible things he was. But yes, I mean, most of them did believe him, especially people like Molotov, were absolute fanatical communists. And they all believed that death was an appropriate political weapon. And they all believed you had to kill at random vast classes of people in order to create the workers' paradise later that they all believed and wished to create. So yes, this is a picture of religious, almost religious fanaticism, and these were believers. And in fact, it's almost sort of useless to try and understand the Bolsheviks as a normal political party. They were a sect. They were a tiny sect, and it was a religious sect. They regarded themselves as knights in shining armor, and they talked all the time about being these brave knights hacking away at their enemies with their broadswords. And they talked all the time about their faith. It's easier to think of them as perhaps more like the Taliban, or the Knights Templars, perhaps. Or perhaps like a little sect like Lyndon LaRouche taking power in America. That's the equivalent.
I want to come back to the circle around him, which changed over a period of years, but some stayed with him, Beria for the longest, perhaps. Did they never worry about disappearing?
Yes, I think they did worry. they did worry a lot, and that was terrifying. Their secretaries were constantly being arrested, their chauffeurs were being arrested. But then, you see, Stalin operated in this bizarre way that he was happiest when he was organising a political struggle, a political case against somebody. And a lot of the time, these cases weren't always fatal. They were just to keep the leader on his toes, to make sure he was loyal, to make sure that he stuck to his work and didn't rise too high. But by the end, it was clear that Molotov and Beria particularly felt they were threatened and might well be arrested and shot just before Stalin's death. And Beria, who was the most devoted to Stalin personally when he rose up in the sort of early 30s, was the one who hated him the most by the end. But Beria was a most fascinating character. I mean, he was definitely the most diabolical criminal of the group. After Stalin, he was also the most gifted, and he could run virtually the entire economy. Nothing was beyond his organizational gifts. And as his daughter-in-law, who lived with him and who I interviewed, told me, she said, you know, in a way, Beria is a tragedy, because being born where he was and rising up in this circle, he became a monster. But if he'd moved to America, he might have well have been chairman of General Motors, she said.
But he was a monster. He killed thousands of people.
He was.
Was willing to do almost anything to continue his ruin.
Yes, he was personally a sadist. Stalin never took part himself in either executions or torture. But Beria was personally a sadist. I mean, you've got to realize, you know, the cabinet would meet in the Kremlin. Lubyanka jail and other jails were very close by in Moscow. You know, the actual torturing was not that far from the cabinet table. In fact, Yezhov, who was another grotesque figure, Stalin's poison dwarf, also an interesting character, he would actually turn up at the cabinet table and they'd say to him, what have you got on your sleeves? You've got speckles on your cuffs. And he would say very proudly, he would show it around the table and he'd say, I'm proud to say I've been working in the prison all night on prisoners, and this is the blood of an enemy of the people, I'm proud to say. So, you know, it was very close yeah. by.
But he was also, he would make Khrushchev dance for him. He would punish some people, but others he would kill and then be terribly appealing to women. He was apparently quite a charmer at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people always quote Kissinger's power as the greatest aphrodisiac to explain it. That's not true at all in his case. Molotov said he was always very appealing to women. And in fact, when he was absolutely a penniless nobody and a prisoner in the exile in Siberia, he was never without a mistress and left illegitimate children all over the place. Wrote his mistress's very passionate love letters, which we now have, and they're in this group of archives. The two things he would always make sure he was never without in exile were a woman, and then when he arrived, he'd always steal the best library from his comrades. He was an absolute fanatical enthusiast for studying and reading, and even in his 70s, he said, I may be in my 70s, but I never stop studying.
Did you, when you were reading through his letters, of course you couldn't do it without already knowing what Stalin had done, but if you were to pick up one of the love letters that he had written, would you guess from the language of it that the man who wrote that letter could also have ordered the death of 50,000 people in one city and 60,000 in another?
Not in the love letters, because they read very much like anybody else's. I mean, the letters which we have from 1930 with his wife are very sweet letters. They could almost be any couple. He says things to her. He calls her Tatka. He called his wife Nadia Tatka. That was his nickname for her. He said, darling Tatka, you know, I miss you so much. When you're coming back, I send you a warm kiss. She would write to him, darling Joseph, I wish you'd kiss me like you kissed me when I was leaving for the country again. It's so boring here. Will you come and visit, will you come and join us, me and the children again? So, you know, they're very like anyone else's letters in that sense. And also, you know, another fascinating thing I found is that these archives are filled with what you might call groupie letters. You know, they're letters from women who wanted to meet him. I mean, one said, dear Comrade Stalin, I'm a 23-year-old teacher from Rostov or somewhere. I'd love to meet you. I dream about you every night. Any chance of an appointment? And then it said, P.S., photograph enclosed, which is quite, gives you an idea of, you know, the sort of worship that he received. And he actually answered that letter personally. And with typical Stalin sort of irony, he said, dear comrade unfamiliar, I can't meet you, though I respect your request to meet me. And I send you my warmest regards, J. Stalin. And then he put, P.S., photograph returned. which is typical. Yeah. And that was in the archives. And there are many like that.
We haven't talked very much about the politics at all, but I guess in many ways that's been dealt with by others. Did you, after all of your interviews with the survivors of this regime, all of your reading through his personal papers in the archives, combined with your knowledge of him before that, did you come up with a different sense of who Stalin really was?
I think that this portrait, this intimate portrait of Stalin and his people, is different. And I think that future historians will have to use this and use this new material in their presentation of him. I mean, yes, I think he does turn out to be a very different person, a much more complex person, much more intellectual. I think it's true to say, and when I say an intellectual, I must be careful what I say. I mean, I think he had a brutish interest in literature. He had a political interest in it, and he would crush anybody who crossed him. But I think he was extremely well-read, though he was an autodidact. And I think it's true to say that he was probably the best-read Russian leader between Catherine the Great and Putin. Even though Lenin, for example, had a nobleman's education and was, you know, classical education. But Stalin was a self-creation, and that's the key thing about him. Everything was political for him, and everything, family, friends, he would toss onto the fire of politics and sacrifice it there. And that's the key thing to understand. Was he one of the great monsters of all history, even though we know these details about him as a nice father and a great reader of books and so on? Yes, he remains the great monster at the end of this book, just as he does at the beginning.
Simon Montefiore is a novelist and the author of the biography Stalin. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Evil's Aftermath, number 1031A. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.